Art Zany, Radio for the Imagination, with your host Paula Granquist, is brought to you by the Northfield Arts Guild and by the Paradise Center for the Arts. And now, Art Zany, Radio for the Imagination.
Good morning, this is Paula Granquist, and you're tuned in to Art Zany, Radio for the Imagination. Thanks so much for tuning in and for staying with us this morning. I hope all is okay with everybody out there after the storms. I've certainly been thinking about our community, and I hope you can take some time to spend a little moment with us and wake up your imagination here. I'm going to talk about first taking pictures, and this is something I used to do when my kids were toddlers. Is I loved to take pictures of them doing things that weren't just the cute things, just the the funny things or the awesome things. I like to take pictures of them doing things like having tantrums, which you know might think is kind of odd, but I really wanted them to remember that your whole childhood was there was ups, there was downs. That's real life. Except I remember one time when my kids, I took a picture of my, I think it was my son who was fussing, and he stopped and turned to me and said, "Mom, delete it." And I knew that I couldn't do that. But I think having the whole story of somebody and the place that we live and the to remember the things that are meaningful is really important. I want evidence of the whole part of the picture of our world. And I think life is this and that and everything. And so taking pictures of just the incredible things or the posed things are, I feel like we'll lose track a little bit of the heart of being a human being. And so I think that's really an important part of what we should think about is what's in our world, what's around us, and what is the nature of everyday life. And I think there's a lot you don't notice because maybe you think about those big events, but the little ones and the day-to-day and the way we interact with our world is really important, and it's a lot of fun to explore. And I'm very thrilled this morning to be able to bring to the show David Lefkowitz. Welcome to Art Zany Radio.
Thank you, Paul. It's great to be here.
It is great to have you because you are the curator and the Bald Spot Museum of Art curator.
Self-appointed.
Yeah. It's a temporary gallery installation at the Bald Spot at Carleton College. And this is up now through November 20th. It's called Landscape and Labor. Or maybe it's a little bit longer. We don't.
Yeah, it depends on how long the construction of the geothermal wells that they're drilling there takes. So
it's something that we wanted to bring to your attention because I think it's a pretty incredible installation that's very thought-provoking. It's very original. It's something I've never seen before. And it really makes you think and makes you ponder some of these questions about how we relate to our experiences in the land and nature and humans interacting with their environment. And so we'll work on describing it as we go through. But just to introduce you, if you don't remember David Lefkowitz from the last time he was on, he teaches painting, drawing, and the Junior Seminar, Critical Issues in Contemporary Art. And he combines Western traditions of representational oil painting and the flotsam and jetsam, love that phrase, of consumer culture to draw attention to the complex relations between image and object, past and present, and nature and culture. And so you can find his works at the Walker, at the Miami Art Museum, and the Langen, is that the correct pronunciation?
Oh, the Langen Foundation, yeah.
In Germany. Yeah, that's what it says on your bio.
I'm not sure that all that work is on display at the moment at those sites, but they have them in their collection.
Right, and that's, I think that's pretty incredible. And I think that's one of the things that I've enjoyed about getting to know you and getting to know your work is you're always thinking of these original and thought-provoking ways, because the last time you were on, we were talking about this is going to come out odd, and it's Nerthfold.
That's good.
say it the way you said
Nerthfold.
It. Yeah, yeah, it's our town without the vowels,
and with the vowels mixed around a little bit.
Oh, that's right.
Right.
Yeah, that's so true. That's exactly. True.
Yeah.
So
it's a slightly askew version of Northfield.
And that was with Doug Bratlander.
Correct.
And that was one of my favorite shows that I've ever had on Art Zany because you two were just, it was a great show. I wish you could all look that up. And now that I've had you on that show, I can't stop spotting those green boxes.
Oh, the monoliths of mystery. Oh, yeah, they're still there. Yeah. Yeah, Northvolt is always present in Northfield. You just have to be looking for the looking at the town in a particular way.
And so, that was pretty thought provoking, sure. and that's a good way to engage in your world to start adding some different perspective to it. Mm-hmm. So tell me what you've been working on. That was a few years ago, and update our listeners on your work and teaching.
Well, I do still teach painting and drawing and occasional seminars and things at Carleton, and I always have multiple ongoing projects. So Northvolt, there was the Northvolt Visitors Bureau at the Arts Guild. I think that's when we talked about it. A few years after that, we had a smaller version of it in the show about walking. There was a big walking festival a few years ago.
Oh, right, that with the cart, yes. Right.
Well, actually, that was a whole separate project.
Oh, my
gosh.
That
was not really a Northvolt. The Peripatetic Gallery. That's another institution that I administer.
that was really fun.
Sure.
And that was what I enjoyed about that one was I think Doug had people taking some photographs, and my daughter took a picture that was like exquisite.
Right.
And I was like, how did she? She didn't worry about the lighting and the framing.
Yeah.
She just kind of looked at her world and said, I want to take a picture of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and then that got posted up on the little gallery.
In our gallery. Yeah. So it's a 3x5 foot gallery on a cart that I will sometimes wheel around and engage. And that particular exhibit was where we asked passersby to, we had Polaroid cameras and asked them to shoot a picture. And I think, so your daughter was one of those lucky artists. And and then we displayed them immediately in the gallery. So there was instant gratification.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Which
you don't often get
True.
So I love the way you twist how we think about art or how we engage with it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And this project is really no different.
And that's true. It sort of continues that idea of, in some ways, thinking of some of the work I do thinks of the exhibit as a medium. I don't know if that makes me an exhibitionist,
but
maybe one way to think about it. Because I'm really interested in the ways that we contextualize our experience to make things meaningful. And one of those, historically visually, is through an art but then through an art exhibit. And so I'm interested in sort of that meta experience of those layers through which we're seeing the world, often through a frame and or through a series of frames on a wall, that we often don't think about those conventions as defining the way we conceptualize things. So,
I think that's a really brilliant way to start a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've always been fascinated with the frame of a piece of work and how it was decided where the edge is.
Right.
And
it's very important.
It is really important. Mm-hmm. And so this exhibit, I want people to know is up now, Landscape and Labor. Mm-hmm. And you might drive to the Carleton College campus, walk or take your bike, and you might just see green fence in the bald spot. That's mm-hmm. the main, if you're not familiar with campus, it's right off of College and
First, it's
right behind the chapel.
Right, exactly.
Is
right in the center of campus, the sort of the campus commons.
Exactly. And so there's a big construction fence, but there is an art exhibit there, and that's what we're here to tell you about. And it's called Landscape and Labor. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, it's a series of frames that are placed within the green wrap. I don't know what they call
it. Just that green fabric that covers the construction fence,
And so I think that's a really intriguing idea. One, just the idea that it offers a window into what's going on.
Precisely.
But which is an unusual, it's a way you don't usually engage with a construction site.
Mm-hmm.
How did this come about?
Well, it partly came about because of my general interest in landscape, in the way we think about our surroundings, but then also the idea that the bald spot, which is a important common area on campus where there's frisbee and in the winter there are rinks there, and that to have that off limits was one's initial reaction is, oh, this is terrible and it's so ugly and because that would be my reaction whenever it would come up in discussion about it being inaccessible over this term, over the fall, this season.
Right.
And I thought, well, what are some ways that you could reconceive sort of how you think about that space? And that was one inspiration. The other was I actually love looking at whatever's going on behind a construction fence. I like seeing that activity. I'm curious about the infrastructure that undergirds the actual structures that we see or things like that. And so I always want to see what's going on in there. And I was when they're also building a new science facility at Carleton, and there's a big green fence like that there, and I was thinking like, I wish I could, you know, you can sort of see over. It's not completely opaque, so you can sort of see through a little bit, but it's a little unsatisfying, the access to what's going on in there. And so I thought, well, maybe there's a way that you could emphasize that. And so I thought, well, it'd be, you know, the idea of a frame or a window. It's sort of like a knot hole, too. You know, there's that idea of sort of looking through that tiny hole to see what's going on. And so I thought I'd open that up a little bit, but not too much, by having creating these little windows. So just and then I thought, well, to place a gold frame around it contextualizes that in a way. It makes it a picture. It makes you more self-conscious about what's going on in your view. And so that was the initial inspiration for that. And I thought, well, that would be kind of – and so I initially – proposed that to Martha Larson, who's the sustainability czar, I guess,
yeah,
of
that's
the facility
of
Carleton facilities, and she and her associate Alex Miller were really excited about the idea of the project. And as I thought, and so they said, I said, you know, this fence is going to be up for a few months. It's just rather than just having empty fence, here's a simple. That's the other thing I like is finding like relatively inexpensive and just rudimentary ways to make these kind of transformations happen. And so it wouldn't take much to cut a hole, find some frames at thrift stores, paint them with gold spray paint, and voila, you've got an exhibit.
Yeah, exactly.
And so that was sort of the initial aspiration. And then it occurred to me there could be other layers by thinking about sort of that reference to other to paintings, initially mostly paintings, but some other artwork that addresses the idea of landscape. And that's where I sort of started doing some research about text panels that you would often see in a museum that provide some context, provide some background information about the imagery that you're seeing. And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to pair those with those little windows to start to make connections about conventional ways that we look at a landscape and think about sort of what landscape means with our everyday experience of the world, like you were saying before. And so that's sort of how that the details of that came about.
That's a phenomenal piece. And I think it's sometimes some of the best ideas are those, like you said, just a really small shift in your perspective mm-hmm. can open up some ideas. And to engage with that exhibit is very satisfying because you get the idea of walking up to that frame and it's like you have permission, look through.
Yeah.
And so you start seeing, well, what is framed in my view, mm-hmm. as well as those quotes that are a part of this exhibit. Exhibit, which is landscape. I forget which word comes first.
Landscape and labor.
The first is landscape, and then labor.
Right.
That add that other element that you were talking about. So maybe we should visit about one of those quotes that they're references to real artwork that exists has been in museums.
That's true.
I don't know where we should start, but maybe we'll start with the.
Well, you'd mentioned that George Ennis when we were talking earlier.
Yes.
And I think that's a good starting point because it's a painting. It's a small painting of a train going through a landscape. And so I was looking for quotes that somehow would make a connection between sort of oftentimes we think of the landscape as just an image of nature. But even just putting a frame around it is about a human sort of imposition of order on what we think of as sort of that chaos. And so I was selected mostly artists from the 19th and early 20th century who were making paintings that were about some of the changes of the landscape as humans become more and more involved in the manipulation of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was looking for quotes that sort of suggested that because that's sort of what's going on.
Should you want to read the quote from?
Sure. I think that might be a good lead into sort of further discussion about it. So some of these quotes are from books or from about the art or from sort of museum labels or from museum websites. This is particular is from the – so this painting is in the National Gallery in Washington, D.C. It's an American painting. George Ennis was a painter in the 19th century of the American landscape. And I'll just read this little quote from the website. So it says, rather than celebrating nature in the tradition of the Hudson River School – George Ennis's Lackawanna Valley seems to commemorate the onset of America's industrial age. Whether it is read as an enthusiastic affirmation of technology or as a belated lament for a rapidly vanishing wilderness, this painting exemplifies a crucial philosophical dilemma that confronted many Americans in the 1850s. Expansion inevitably necessitated the widespread destruction of unspoiled nature, itself a still powerful symbol of the nation's greatness. The picture serves as a poignant pictorial reminder of the ephemeral nature of the American dream. So there's a lot going on in there.
There's a lot to unpack in that one quote, but it does give you that, I think that's part of the experience that I had with that exhibit was just the idea of, one, you're at a site where geothermal, you know, something is happening that you maybe don't know a lot about. Right. And it's in order to make that happen, they have to take away some of the bald spot to do that. Mm-hmm. But we're and you think sometimes that nature is finished, right? Like it's there's an end, but we're constantly interacting with that for our good, for nature's good sometimes.
Right. Yeah.
Nature itself changes its so there's that engagement. And so when he talks about the ephemeral nature of the American dream, I was really reflecting on that idea of how our place in this world, we make it and we change it. And
And it changes, too, in ways that we can't even know sort of the degree to which it's our – I mean, I think that's one of the big issues about global warming. I mean, that may be a leap, but I don't think it's a far leap to think about and even something like the storm that occurred. I mean, so that's a natural phenomenon. It's a natural storm. But how much is the fact of these sort of the seeming sort of greater frequency of storms like this with that kind of power – a function of human interaction in the landscape, and there's certainly scientists and researchers that are trying to determine some of that. But so it's ambiguous as to what that space between nature as this separate thing and human activity as something else is. One of those dichotomies that I think a lot of my work for a long time has been trying to sort of get us to question a little bit, and this is no exception. And so that quote really, I think, draws attention to those
right,
those
and to
kind
think
of
that
issues.
That was he was working in the 1850s is kind of phenomenal to imagine that resonated back then, and here we are.
Yeah,
you know, I don't know. I can't do the math that fast. Yeah.
Well, it's also complicated because I mean, it's easy to think of sort of the exploitation of the landscape and resource allocation that does a lot of damage to the landscape. And that's why it's sort of interesting in this context. It's more complex because this damage to, well, the bald spot, the campus is already a very controlled, mediated environment that's often made to look like it's natural. That's a whole nother thing that this is also about. The idea that the construction that's going on there now is in order to make a more sustainable use of energy that supplies the campus over a long term, to try to build a sort of a the idea is that by 2050 we'll have a completely carbon free campus energy plan, that this geothermal energy that will come through will be also supported by the wind turbines and other more sustainable energy practices to try to minimize our reliance on fossil fuels and other things that do a lot of damage to the planet. So it's complicated.
Yeah, and you know, I had that same thought of the idea of how exciting it is that they're doing geothermal, and it's something not a lot of us know about, but yet it also had that thought of, wow, we're constantly having to reinvent how we get energy, and you know, maybe we've with that, you know, there are unintended consequences or ways that we engage that make shifts that, like you said, we may not be aware of. And so it's this constant evolution that gave me a great sense of time and human problems haven't changed.
Well, they've changed, but they have and they haven't, you know?
Yeah.
There's various technological changes, but that I don't know, that make us sort of reconceive of sort of how we interact with one another and with the land. I don't know. I don't know where I'm going with
this. No, that's okay. It's a phenomenal, and that's just one. There's 11 of these frames,
yeah.
And then there's each one is accompanied by a quote. I thought it was really fascinating that you chose not to put images of either the artist or the time or the reference. Mm-hmm. I'd love you to visit about that, because I found myself wanting to see what they saw.
Yeah, sure.
But I had to see what I saw.
Right. So I thought about that a lot. And I actually, one of the other things I'm interested in is the different types of representations that we as humans use to describe the world. And so text is certainly one. Imagery, reproduction, a representation of nature is one. And then even those representations have different nuances. A painting of a landscape requires a different kind of making process than a photograph. And even a photograph by Ansel Adams is very different from one of, you know, that you take on your smartphone. That each of those technologies sort of necessitates a particular way of and a time process too. There's sort of the element of time. It takes a long time to make a painting compared to using your phone to Snapchat your and I think those different image making strategies are have subtle different differences in sort of how we read those images.
And so I
thought about including an image of the painting in this, but I thought, you know, one of the reasons I didn't was because I would hope that if somebody is intrigued by seeing that now, I mean, we have the technology where if you do have a phone, you can just sort of Google that image and Google that text of the title of that painting or that artist, and you can find it pretty quickly. And so I sort of wanted viewers to do some of the work if they wanted to, if they're intrigued. I didn't want
to
spoon feed completely. I think a lot of museums do. I mean, I think it's understandable, but I feel like they sometimes pander to the expectation that the visitor needs to have everything presented for them. And one thing I liked about this structure was that there's certainly a lot to see and to read, but that there's also something that's not revealed, but that requires a little bit of work on the visitor's part.
I think that's a really interesting way to think about, and something I have never thought about, but I think you're onto something, because the experience at a museum sometimes is, you know, repetitive, and if they provide all, you know, like, it's tiring to read everything and look at all the pictures.
Yeah, sometimes it's too much information.
Right, exactly. And you're like, okay, I can't do this for, you know, all 8 hours, right? But I want to see everything.
Right.
And so if you allow people to kind of create their own pathway by interacting and changing what they discover and letting them discover, you engage in a different way.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like there's plenty of information in this particular exhibit, but that it's there's also an option to experience. I mean, this is true with any art. There's sort of different layers and levels on which you can experience things.
But we're not
purely visual. But I don't think anything's ever purely visual, because we all bring our own sort of history and baggage to every image that we see.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that setting the stage for thinking about what's the relation between something that you're seeing in real time through this little like window and some textual information about it that may not be an exact correspondence, but forces a kind of connection. It was part of the inspiration for doing it this way. So,
And that does. And that's what I love about what you do, is because it makes me think about things in a new way. And I want to remind our listeners, you're tuned in to KYMN. I hope you're enjoying our conversation. I'm here with David Lefkowitz, and we're talking about Landscape and Labor, which is a temporary installation at the Carleton College Bald Spot. it has a name.
It's the Bald Spot Museum of Art.
Right. I should
give
it.
There's also there's the Bald Spot Natural History Museum, which is there's like a panel that shows has information if you about the geothermal energy project too.
Oh, I didn't know that was a museum too.
Well, it is. I'm just sort of declaring it so. And then there's the Bald Spot Children's Museum because there's some reproductions of images that some Northfield school kids have made about sort of the prompts that were made through prompts about sort of their views of the environment and sort of how they see their relation to the natural world and to just the environment.
And that was a really fun thing to discover as you went there. And I think it made me, I was pleased to see that really imagination is what's going to take us to whatever that is. That you have to engage with the technology and all of those aspects. But in order to do that, you have to be able to use your imagination to, solve a problem, to figure it out. And it was really fascinating what the kids drew.
Yeah.
And I was also surprised there are a lot of hovercrafts.
I know. I love those.
All right, so that's what they're dreaming about. But they may be onto something that we can't even envision.
That's true.
And it's our little tiny temporary spot that we're here in this earth.
Yeah.
And we may or may not get to see that. Mm-hmm. It may be a fantasy. It may be actual reality.
Yeah.
And so it does. It takes you through that whole experience. Mm-hmm. And so that's on. So walk all four sides of the
walk
fence.
Walk all the way around. Yeah.
I think it's a beautiful thing. And we should talk about the one I want to make sure we get to, because this really intrigued me, was the Sweeper Ballet.
Sure. So I can first preface that by talking a little bit about the choices of the art that I, because there's lots of other art I could have included. And I also thought about the number and size and scale of things. And so the size of the windows of the frames was more determined just because of the scale. That's about 5 feet or 6 feet high sort of walls. And so I thought initially about, well, what if the frames were exactly the dimensions of the actual paintings? But some of them are enormous.
Mm.
Some of them are tiny. And some of them, like this one, isn't really even a painting. So so I thought it made more sense to organize them in a way that sort of really did provide a window that made sort of an intimate view for people that sort of drew attention to that. So that was one of the scale choices. Then I also thought, well, you could go back through the history of humankind to Roman, back to Egyptian, to find examples of human interaction with nature. But I thought that would just be trying to do too much in one little exhibit. And so I sort of started with paintings from the 19th century, from the period when the Industrial Revolution really started developing, because of the specificity of this industrial construction site. And I thought that would be a good point. Also, it was a point at which I think artists and writers started to really notice the idea of the environment, partly because the impact of human activity was so palpable in the factories in England and things like that, that I think in some ways, ironically, our appreciation of nature and the environment was heightened by the fact of seeing situations where that wasn't the case.
The contrast of
the
our immersion and changing things with what was already nature's way.
If you think about the before the Industrial Revolution, I think that nature was actually, and for most people, and for a lot of people, it still is, was seen as threatening or scary frequently, because you don't have control over it.
Sure. Oh, and then we have mythologies,
Altered
history to explain.
And so a lot of human activity is about trying to figure out ways to gain some control, some agency over your own experience. And so, but then when that seems like more problems were the result of human activity, like the pollution from factories. And I mean, I guess in England is one place I can think of where those kind of ideas started to develop about nature, sort of John Ruskin, who sort of romanticized nature, and those artists and thinkers at that time was a response to the damage that was done by human industry on that scale. And And so that's so some of the images that I selected or paint some of the paintings initially sort of referred to some of that or were responses to that. And then into the and then so there's some examples from European painters and then into some American painters from the early 20th century. Charles Sheeler is one who made these images of the built landscape, and Grant Wood, who's most famous for this, the American Gothic. But I chose a painting of his called "Breaking the Prairie," partly because it's more specific to the Midwest, and so it refers more particularly to our particular location. I'm getting around to what you were asking.
No, because that one was another one that really piqued my interest because I didn't know that painting of his, and that was the one that referenced farmers. Yes,
right, sure, yeah,
and that. Was the farmers, therefore, are the founders of human civilization. And his argument is that...
Daniel Webster quote.
Right. That are the ones that are changing, like, that control aspect. And it was, that was something, another thought that had never entered my... So that was fun. So you have a whole range, and we're going to get to those.
And I thought about it just sort of leaving it to paintings, but then there's a few contemporary artists, or artists working in the last 50 years or so, who I thought were really important to mention and who I really am inspired by a lot. And so I thought making reference to some of their work, too, is important. And one of those, the one I'm now getting around here, is this artist Mira Leiter-Manukalis, who is still working. She's, I think she must be right around 80 now, but she... In the 60s, or sort of late 60s, early 70s, became the sort of self-appointed artist in residence for the New York Sanitation Department. Because she felt like here's an important aspect of our city that not only doesn't get recognized, but is debased, that people, look down on garbage men and garbage women, I guess, too. There were not very many, but she felt like it was really important to draw attention to that. And some of her other sort of early conceptual work was about women's work, about cleaning, and other things that sort of were debased labor, or labor that wasn't seen as being valuable or important, and to draw attention to, well, this really is actually important, and we should, as a culture, acknowledge that. And so, but the project of hers that I reference in this event that she helped organize of a in New York City, and I think it was in the early 80s, called Ballet Mécanique for Six Mechanical Sweepers, in which she had choreographed these. Part of the quote in the thing is the performers were large, somewhat ungainly, yet surprisingly agile and graceful pieces of heavy duty equipment, driven with virtuosity by their operators, and. In some ways, that's sort of a version of that activity is going on, not in quite as self-conscious a way, inside. Especially earlier in the a month or so ago, when those big drills for drilling deep down into these 500-foot wells that where they're putting piping in for the geothermal system. It made me think of that work and to be more intentional about thinking about what are you framing, what are we looking at, the way that she recontextualized that activity as something worthy of our attention and worthy of recognition was something I wanted to make reference to. So.
Yeah, and that was a piece that, I hadn't heard of her work and also, it instantly tried to imagine what the ballet of sweepers.
You can find it, I think, on YouTube.
Is there a YouTube?
Yeah, I think you can find information. That's the thing. If you just Google her, you can find a lot of information about that work. Yeah.
And I think that helps us to think of the ballet of that you mentioned, of all of the things that have to happen in order for this project to be done, or any construction project. Uh-huh. There's an art to that.
Sure.
There's a timeline. There's a beginning. There's a middle, and so there's a lot of parallels.
Yeah.
And I think that it draws attention to that. And it was really fun just the way that the pictures framed. Some of the equipment that was inside of the fences.
Sure.
And I was like, I got to get a picture of this. This is so cool.
Right, yeah.
and that was an unexpected reaction.
Yeah. Well, and that's partly what I hope to achieve by some of work like this is that to create an element of surprise or to sort of set up a situation where you're it's not so that a gallery wall is a fairly familiar thing, at least in our culture, but having it in that location is very unfamiliar. And so it's taking things that someone is are sort of conventional ways of presenting visual information that someone might recognize, but taking them completely out of sort of the normal sort of venue in which you'd see them.
Mm-hmm.
And through that that surprise sort of generates the kind of interest that I would hope they would.
Exactly. And it kind of reminded me when my kids were in strollers, that was one of the things we used to do was to go to construction sites because they were just in awe of any piece of equipment.
Yeah. And it's impressive.
And we forget maybe as we get older to think about that wonder and awe that's ever present.
That's true.
And this exhibit most certainly illuminates that. And again, it is at the Bald Spot at Carleton College. It's here through when the project is done, at least November.
I think, it sounds like the fence is going to be up through the middle of November, maybe late. It could be longer. And so it'll just stay up until until the Bald Spot is available again for
Probably broom ball.
Although I'm not sure we're going to get to the broom. I don't know. I think it depends on the just sort of the progress of the project as to when it will be available again.
And tell
definitely by spring.
Tell us about the reactions of the people that are coming to work on the project or students. How are the people engaging with it?
I think people. I've gotten lots of positive feedback from friends and some students about sort of I just came upon that. I was surprised to see it and so I've got. The thing is, people aren't going to come up to me and tell me they hate that. So
but that would be a reaction that would be a surprise, right?
Yeah, that's true.
And then you could engage in a conversation it does what you wanted it to achieve too is to.
Well, and one of my initial concerns was part of the reason for doing that is I wanted folks to recognize there's this important labor going on, this part of activity, and we should be attentive to that because I think usually you see there's certainly a hierarchy of status of different jobs, especially at a campus like that, and to recognize that, well, there's these other people who are doing this activity that's really important for all of us is worthy. But the risk is by framing them like that, they just become sort of zoo animals or it's a recontextual. And I was a little nervous about sort of how that would come off. I think by adding those text panels, it changes that a little bit. It adds another layer. But it's still something that, so I think someone might go in and say, like, oh, this is terrible. It's like, no, they're just on display. But it's a trade-off, and I think it's worth that risk to generate a kind of, I don't know, teaching moment about these things. And I've talked to – when I was hoping we could schedule some event or activity when we could get, have me bring the – and we still might do this. I've been talking to Martha a little bit about it. To have a gallery opening, but also have maybe the foreman or some of the workers come in and talk about what's going on in there, and that I think would be a really great kind of activity to use that as the exhibit as sort of a spark for that kind of interaction. Sometimes some of the workers that I talked to when I was working on it, setting it up, were curious, and I was explaining, and they were really engaged and interested in it. Others were sort of like, oh, it's just a pile of mud. It's like, they're right. That's true. So it's like, I got to admit, that's that way of reading that space, that is also a legitimate understanding of.
Right. Yeah, that's true. And but everybody has a perspective, and it's fun when you can sort of move somebody's perspective off a couple degrees.
Yeah,
and
that's what I'm trying to do.
Give them a new opportunity to engage with what they're already doing or what's already around them. Because I think even if windows weren't there, they're not, the frames, people would still be curious and they would be looking. And this gives it a way to maybe have some permission to engage.
Yeah.
And permission sometimes is just all that we need to move ahead with that.
Right. Yeah.
So I think there's another one we wanted to talk about of those quotes, because we have a few more minutes on the show to do that.
Sure.
I don't know which one we want to do. Which one do you think is the next best
you
one?
You can choose. There's, I don't know. That they all have some elements. Some of them sort of are repetitious or repeat things that we've already talked about. So I'm trying to think if there's a...
Should we talk about the one with the Ford from
the American landscape, that Charles Sheeler painting? Yeah, so we've touched on this before, but it certainly bears mentioning again. And actually, there's a detail in this that sort of that reinforces some of the things we've talked about. So Charles Sheeler was a painter in the early 20th century, American painter who did a lot of imagery that sort of was abstract, but abstracted from the built environment, from American factories and sort of modernist sort of architectural structures as well. But also just that with sort of imagery, he was of industry, basically. So the quote says, "Although the title American Landscape may evoke a rural scene, Sheeler's subject here is the Ford Motor Company plant on the River Rogue near Detroit, Michigan. Missing from Sheeler's images are the people who worked in the factory, perhaps reflecting an ambivalence about the country's shift toward the industrial." And, you know, we've touched on this already, but I do think that that's an important connection, is sort of we have collectively sort of ideas and images about what the American landscape means. And sometimes, you know, images of like Yosemite or Yellowstone dominate that initial sort of first reaction to what does the American landscape mean.
Mm-hmm.
And there have certainly been lots of support for promoting that particular view, and maybe sort of not notice or not being attentive to other things, other aspects of our experience. And so I think Sheeler is drawing attention to that. And the American landscape is more diverse, more complicated than sort of the pristine nature as being the only ideal. And so it touches on some of those issues.
Yeah, and I thought that was it's really interesting. And I think about it in terms of Northfield, too, that sometimes we have these separate identities of downtown and rural, and there aren't a lot of bridges that bring those worlds together. And I thought maybe it's the artist that can help us. And so, I have these visions of, so we take the sweeper reference and we take the big farm equipment and, you know, there's something that could brew in there that could help us to see even our small world in a new way.
Yeah. Well, but Northfold kind of did that too. I mean, that was sort of that was the inspiration for that too, was that, that sort of tension between wanting to promote a small town for preserving what seems to be its sort of greatest qualities, but also wanting to get bigger and grow. And so are those necessarily compatible? Maybe not sometimes. And so Northfold was sort of a reaction to that that phenomenon.
You're always bringing us great questions. And I think that great art starts with great questions.
I think so, too.
And that you can, you know, it's just a matter of taking a moment to engage. And so that's why art is so important, because it gives us that opportunity to once again think about our world. And this exhibit is really something special. And I really want people to come and see. Again, it's Landscape and Labor. I think we've touched on it, but there's a lot more that we didn't get to touch on. So,
go and see it.
That's right. People need to.
It's on yourself.
Right. And the fall is a perfect time to come to campus.
Yeah.
Take your bike, take a walk.
Absolutely.
Any version will work. It is called Landscape and Labor at the Carleton College Bald Spot Museum of Art, which is just behind the chapel. That's the easiest reference point to give you.
Sure.
And that'll be up through November. And if you let us know if that event happens where you have...
Yeah, definitely will. Yeah. If we get organized about putting something like that together, I'd love to.
Yeah, then we'll make sure and promote it on Art Zany.
Great.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, Paula, for inviting me. This has been great to get a chance to talk about it.
I think so. It's one of those that came to my attention because we happened to see each other at the farm.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And that's a great thing about our community. Sure. So, folks, this is Art Zaney, Radio for the Imagination. I really enjoy sharing these stories with you and hope that you continue to engage your imagination with us. I want to let you know about a couple of things that are happening. Last week, my guests were from the Population 485, the new play at the Northfield Arts Guild. This is based on Michael Perry's book, and it is a memoir, and it is just, this is his new stage version about his childhood town of New Auburn, Wisconsin, and a lot of the things we're talking about here, because he comes back home and works in the volunteer fire department, and it's a heartbreaking, captivating story, and that opens tonight at the Northfield Arts Guild. You can get tickets, northfieldartsguild.org, and runs for 2 weekends, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Friday and Saturday shows are at 7:30, and the Sunday show is at 2 p.m., so I hope that you will make time for that. It's one of my favorite books. It really is a good thought-provoking story, and so I think that's something that you should also check out. And there's a story of Faribault that is coming to the Paradise Center for the Arts that you should know about. It's called A Celebration of Faribault, the 1855 live show, and this is from the creators of the Faribault Community Television documentary series, 1855. It's Logan Ledman and Samuel Temple, and they host a journey through Faribault's compelling and inspiring story in a commemoration of the town and its history, and that is the 21st, 23rd, 28th, and 30th. So it's not Saturdays, but it's Fridays and Sundays. You can check out Paradise Center for the Arts for those details. I know some folks involved in this, and they have been just so excited to share this with everybody. So please do go and visit at the Paradise for the celebration of Faribault, the 1855 live show. And also I want to bring from our poet laureate, Rob Hardy. He mentions the second annual Northfield Poetry Festival that starts on Saturday, the 29th of September. And there are readings from, this one is happening at 10 a.m. on the 29th at Content. Readings from Minnesota poet laureate Joyce Sutphen. I hope I'm saying her name correctly. She's a poet that I've admired for a long time, so it's very exciting that she's coming to Northfield. Also with local Northfield poets, Becky Bowling, D.E. Green, Diane LeBlanc, Susan Jarrett McKinstry, Steve McCowan, and Leslie Schultz will be reading. So that is a powerhouse lineup, an extraordinary event. But that's just the first event of the second annual Northfield Poetry Festival. On the 29th at 1 p.m. at the Northfield Public Library, the Latinx Spoken Word Collective, Paula Bristis, Lupe Castillo, Marianne Gomez, and Magdalena Caluza are presenting an event. That sounds fascinating. I don't know anything about their group, and I'm really excited to learn about them. On Sunday the 30th, Patrick Scully of, I believe he was of Patrick's Cabaret before, has a one-person show on Walt Whitman, Leaves of Grass Illuminated, at 7:30 at the Arts Guild Theater. Phenomenal. What a lineup. How could you possibly even, but there's more. On the 1st of October, on Monday, the poet spoken word artist Bao Phi is coming to Northfield. He is a Minnesota Book Award children's author. He's the City Pages Artist of the Year last year, and an incredible advocate for poetry, and just a really talented young, maybe, I don't know, we're all older now, but that's at 7 p.m. at Content on Monday the 1st. So a lot happening in this town. There's always ways to engage with art, and I hope that you take some time every day to find those places and add some Art Zaney to your life. So I really appreciate that you listen. I hope that you enjoy your imagination.
You've been listening to Art Zaney, Radio for the Imagination, with your host, Paula Granquist. Art Zaney is brought to you each week by the Northfield Arts Guild and by the Paradise Center for the Arts in Faribault. A national award-winning comedian performs at the Paradise Center for the Arts in historic downtown Faribault this Saturday, September 22nd at 7:30 p.m. Jen Kober, winner of NPR's Snap Judgment, brings crowds to their feet with her original blend of stand-up, storytelling, and improvised rock and roll comedy. Also premiering this week is A Celebration of Faribault, written and directed by local high school students Samuel Temple and Logan Ledman, and based on their hit 1855 live TV show. For more info or to purchase tickets, go to ParadiseCenterForTheArts.org or call 507-332-7372.